Hour number two with Jim Mars and Dick Allgaier. Fascinating material. Absolutely fascinating. I think one thing we need to mention, Jim, you and I have talked about this before, is how many people were there at Dealey Plaza in Dallas on November 22nd. People that really never would be there under any normal circumstance, or very unlikely.
Right. Well, as Dick said, the sky was blue, the sun was out. There had been some rain that morning, but it had cleared off by about 10 o'clock, and by noon and 12:30 when the assassination happened, it was clear blue. It was Indian summer, autumn. It was warm, but not Texas summer hot, and no clouds. It was just beautiful, and it was a Friday, and on Friday, Texas is always in a tizzy because Friday night football, all the high schools, all the games going on, and so it was. There was just a feeling of, you know, energy in the air, and it had been in the Dallas-Fort Worth papers. They had really been talking for weeks about the visit of the president, and so there were, you know, anyone who could, I think, in Dallas went to try to see the president. My own wife Carol, who was at school at the time, she got loose and went down, and I think she was on Harry Hines when the motorcade went by, so she got to see him as he went by. And, yeah, it was a beautiful day, and there was all kinds of people. I think there was probably between 400 and 500 people in Dealey Plaza, of course.
We're talking about movers and shakers that were there.
Just about everybody.
Yep.
The best one is General Edwin Lansdale, who was in charge of Operation Mongoose, which was the secret war against Castro.
Uh-huh.
And included CIA operatives and mafia hitmen and anti-Castro Cubans, and they were involved in all kinds of things going against Castro, up to and including assassination. And he was photographed walking past these three men who were arrested in boxcars following the assassination, and both Colonel Prouty, who worked directly under Lansdale, and General Kulak, who also worked closely with them, both have on the public record saying, yes, that was Lansdale.
Him. Yeah.
Yeah.
That this picture you just sent me.
And then,
my.
I'm not preparing to say this is him because I can't prove that, but you can see the picture of the fellow standing in front of the book depository minutes after the assassination. Police are swarming all around, and he certainly does look exactly like a young George Herbert Walker Bush. And Bush is, like Richard Nixon, is one of the few people who really can't quite remember where they were at the time of the assassination.
It's true. It's
several
true.
Different stories.
Yes, I remember that. Now, you also sent me a picture of George W. Bush. Apparently, it looks to me like that's him.
It looks pretty close to me, too, but I'm not going to say that as a statement.
Well, I understand. You're a journalist, and I am, too, but it sure as hell looks very convenient and close, and Dad took his 17-year-old son to be at history as it was unfolding. No other reason for it.
One day, son, you may be in the White House, and you need to know that you need to follow orders, you know.
That's a damn truth.
Well,
all right.
Let me quickly mention two of the things that I sent you that you have posted, and I want to make sure people understand what that is. On the one where you've got my pictures, there is a newspaper article, the headline from the Dallas Morning News. This is written by Earl Goldsmith, my counterpart. He was working on assassination stories in Dallas, and I was working on assassination stories for the Forest Star Telegram. But his story says, Secret Service imposters spotted by JFK witnesses. And we know this to be true because several of the bystanders, including some police officers, and met people who showed them identification and said, Secret Service, don't come back here, or everything's okay here, move along, you know. And yet, as Earl Goldsmith points out here, none of the Secret Service agents assigned to Kennedy ever got off in Dealey Plaza, and most of them were at the trademark where he was due to deliver a speech. So I mention this because Dick, in his presentation mentions that there were people with fake IDs. Well, here they are. And then the bottom picture that shows a Chevrolet, but the two circle things, the circle towards the center, that's Kennedy's limousine entering the tripled underpass. And the circle towards the upper right is a puff of gun smoke drifting off the grassy knoll, exactly where everybody said it did. And yet for years and years, they, meaning the debunkers and the government, has tried to argue that modern rifles do not smoke, so this could not, there could not be any smoke coming from the grassy knoll.
Because,
of course, there was nobody up there. Well, there it is, folks. There's the picture of the gun smoke coming off the grassy knoll, and I can assure you, as one who has fired many a rifle, especially
smoke.
If it's freshly oiled, you will get a nice little puff of white smoke.
That's amazing. That picture is absolutely amazing. Just amazing. The 1960 Chevrolet there, pulling away. And you look at the rest of the pictures, people walking across Dealey Plaza, some running.
You see the people below the white. Now, there's some people standing up. That's some of the press people. When the shooting stopped, the motorcade kind of jumped to a halt, and some of the press people, they were all in a bus, and they were also in cars. I got an idea that Chevrolet probably has newsmen in it, okay?
Uh-huh.
And half of them were shouting, step on the gas and follow the president, and the other half were saying, stop, let me out. Okay, so some of them did get out, and the man standing there, I think, is one of the reporters, because they jumped out, ran around, took pictures, but what you can see behind him are people lying on the grass, and that was the Bill Newman family, very famous photographs of Bill Newman and his wife, Gail, and they had two small children with them, and they fell down and covered the children with their own bodies to protect them, and Bill Newman told me and told everybody, that's why you never heard from him very much, the major control media didn't want to talk to him, because he said the shots were coming right from behind them and over their head, which was the grassy knoll.
Wow. Which picture in your group has them laying on the grass?
I see
two people up at the monument.
No. The picture with the smoke coming off the grassy knoll?
Yeah.
Look behind the man standing there, and you'll see somebody lying prone on the grass.
No, oh, yeah.
The one below it, the color one with
there,
the
it's
motorcycle
below.
Cop, you can
it's,
see.
It's right below the black and white picture with the 60 Chevy in it and the puff of smoke, Jim. There's a color picture with two people laying on the grass.
Okay.
And they are, let me see with my magnifying glass. No, the mother's covering up a child. Yeah.
That's the Newman family.
Yeah, that's it. And the father's got one and she's got another one.
That's right, Bill and Gail Newman.
And there's a motorcycle passing by.
They lived in Dallas forever and ever. They still live in a suburb of Dallas today. They're still alive. Okay, they still say the exact same thing, that shots came from the grassy knoll. They were probably some of the closest witnesses to what happened, and yet they were never called to testify to the federal investigation, the Warren Commission, and they've never been interviewed by the mainstream media. And yet they were in the Dallas phone book. I pick up the phone and called them many times.
Well, they're very lucky that they're alive.
That's true. Maybe it is lucky that they didn't get any prominent publicity.
Yeah, they would have. How many people were removed from the planet after that? Lots.
Well, I quit counting after about 100.
There you go. All right. Now, these people in the picture, the big picture, they're running across the street. The motorcade is sped on. They're obviously in shock. They know something horrible has happened. They don't yet know that the president is dead unless they were able to see it. Wow.
Which pictures are you looking at, Jeff?
Well, I'm looking at the big one of people running across toward
right,
the camera.
But I mean, where are they?
They're under your name.
It's not on Diggs.
No. If you look in guests, you'll see your name. Click under your name that says photos, Jim Mars photos.
Yeah.
That's where they all are. You see?
Oh, okay, good. Yeah, I guess I had the old one. Yeah, you see the Newman family there, and you see the guy holding the camera. These are all news guys. They jumped out of the press bus.
Uh-huh.
And running all around, and then the picture below that shows all the people rushing towards the grassy knoll because they all knew where it came from. And by the way, this again is totally supported by what Dick was saying. Dick, you remember you were saying that you were drawing all these people, and some of them were going, "Oh my God!" And they had the hand up to their mouth, and they're doing all this stuff. And you said that they had moved down. They had moved down. See all these people in the upper picture of that upper right corner of that picture.
Yeah.
Most of the people on the south side of Elm Street had been up at the intersection of Main and Houston. Mm-hmm. And when the motorcade came past that colonnade up there and then made the turn onto Elm Street, they began to trickle and run and move down so they could get another look at him.
Around the corner, sure.
Yeah. And by the way, there's something I need to tell you about that because I think it's very, very pertinent. Gene Hill and Mary Mormon, who took some photographs and were some very close witnesses, and a fellow I talked to who had been with a parochial school. And, of course, Kennedy was a Catholic, and so they all went to see the president. And all of these people said that they originally got down and moved down into that grassy area on the south side of Elm Street depicted in the background of that photograph, but a cop came along and told them they couldn't stay there. And they said, why not? Because after all, Kennedy was coming down the motorcade. He was to be seen and waved at and everything else. And the cop said, well, I have orders to keep people off of this area.
That's why there were so few people
there. That's why there were so few people
there.
But like Gene Hill and Mary Mormon then went up and stood on the corner of Main and Houston and Elm,
yeah,
and got to chatting up one of the police officers up there. And as the motorcade came, they sweet-talked him into letting them go further down in the plaza. That's why they were down there. Now, this, to me, is just really telling because Kennedy was there on a public goodwill tour. Everybody took, you know, kiss babies and glad hand everybody. So why would there be orders to police officers to keep people from that south side of Elm Street?
Yeah.
And the only rational idea I can come up with is because somewhere somebody knew bullets were going to be impacting in that area,
yep,
and they didn't want a bystander to get hit because they couldn't, you know, they couldn't illegally take them
it
off.
It blew
to
their lone gunman thing.
Kennedy.
It blew their lone gunman story to pieces if people started getting hit over there.
That's right.
Wow. All right, take a look at the rest of the pictures.
I'm going to say wow, too, because I'm learning things that I didn't know but were in my session. Holy moly.
Yeah, look,
you know,
look at the picture. Dick, one more thing, please. Look at the picture on Jim's photos. Go down from the big, big picture of people running across the street toward the camera. Go 1, 2, 3 before that, and then you'll see a picture with the motorcade, the Lincoln, on the right, moving right to left, and you'll see people kind of moving toward it to get a look. Now, look how few people are there. That's what I'm talking about.
That's
very
right.
Few people on this side of the street.
All the people in foreground are just now moving into
just
that
now
area.
Going into there.
The only people down there was Gene Hill in the red raincoat, Mary Mormon standing next to her in the black raincoat, Charles Brim and his son, and
wow,
then Beverly Oliver, who was unknown for a number of years and came to be known as the Babushka Lady, okay?
You got this so nailed. That's incredible. Wow.
Jim, where did you get that picture? Where did you get that picture?
I can't even tell you right now. It's been around for a long time. Some of the photo experts could tell you where it came from. I've had it for so long that, in fact, I have a copy that I have gone in and identified almost all these people over there, except I want to call your attention to the guy kind of in the center with the people moving in there. He's got a hat on. He's got kind of a tan jacket. Do you see him?
Sure do.
All right, look directly above him, and you see a guy holding an umbrella.
Across the street.
Across the street, a guy holding an umbrella, and directly parallel to him is a guy holding his fist up in the air, okay?
I got it.
Now, we know from the Zapruder film that just as Kennedy's car gets opposite of these two fellas, the guy with the umbrella starts pumping his umbrella up and down and twirling it, okay? Now, look at the sky. Look how sunny. Look at the shadows. There's no reason to even have an umbrella.
See the black
there.
Umbrella, folks? If you
the
look above
umbrella,
his head, it's
it
black.
Is. And then the guy in front of him is like raising his fist in the air. And then after the assassination for about 15 or 20 years, they identified everybody in this picture except those two guys. And the FBI said they couldn't figure out who that was. And
well,
yet these two guys, after the shooting, they're captured in the background of photographs. The guy with the umbrella furls his umbrella up, goes and sits on the curb. The guy in front of him goes and sits right beside him and starts talking on a radio, okay? And with his antenna, you can see it sticking out from behind his. And then they separate. The guy with the umbrella moves up towards the book depository to the east, and the guy in the white jacket then saunters off towards the triple underpass, sticking the radio back into his hip pocket or the back of his pants.
This is astounding to me.
And yet the government said at the time of the House committee, there was a fellow who came forward that said, "Oh, I was the umbrella man," and yet the account he gave does not in any way match with the photographs that were taken. So most of the serious researchers don't believe that he was truly the umbrella man. And the guy with the radio, to this day, the government says, we don't know who that was and we don't know what he was doing.
Yeah, right. all right, this is the caption for this photo, and then we're going to go back to Dick. The first shots have been fired in this photo, but the headshot is still
right
to come. That Kennedy
he's already wounded here, but then as he passes these two, they give these signals, and I think they were visual signals to the hit team saying more shots are required.
I agree.
And then when he gets down there, just almost opposite Gene Hill, Mary Mormon, and the Newman family,
the lady in the red coat,
where the headshot took place.
The lady in the red coat, and they look across the street, and you'll see the family. All right.
And let me tell you this. You can still see vestiges of it today. On the south side of Elm Street, that long curving curb, there are still traces of yellow paint. And in the Zapruder film, if you look really close and slow it down, you can see these streaks, the bright yellow streaks as they go by. And so it's only about 2 foot, and then there's about a 10-foot space, and then there's another 2 foot of yellow paint. Now,
that's a kill zone mark out.
Exactly, because what else could it be? If you wanted no parking, the whole curb would be red, or if you wanted a caution, you'd paint the whole curb yellow. You don't make too little, because right in between these two yellow streaks of paint is where the headshot was delivered.
Oh, my. They had this plan so well.
Oh, this is a typical military triangulation of fire hit teams. You know, they had it all covered from start to finish.
That's incredible.
But this is what happens when we have, as Dick himself says towards the end of his presentation, a coup d'etat in this country.
That picture is astonishing. That picture is astounding. And that you identified those people and know who they are is even more incredible.
Well,
That's why it was
astounding to me. And Dick, I think you'll appreciate this and you'll agree with me. All of this stuff I'm showing right now, this is not new stuff. I've had this stuff since the late 60s.
Oh, understood.
Certainly the early 70s. And I've been screaming and hollering trying to tell people about it. But the media will not cover it. And so most of this stuff has never been seen by the public.
Well, you're hearing it here, thank God, and it'll be available. The pictures are going to stay with the program. Listen, this is crucial history you're looking at, and Dick Allgaier was there as you can be if you're a time traveler.
And Dick gave a very, very accurate description of everything.
Yeah, Dick, please go ahead.
Well, where I was those people in that big picture, I was in that grassy spot. That was my vantage point. This is amazing to me because I didn't know a lot of this stuff. I didn't know about the radios. I didn't know that there was an area where people weren't allowed to go and there were people with badges.
Well, they were trying to keep them away from the line of fire so they wouldn't get killed.
Well, okay. Dick, this is what I said at the very beginning of this. You really hacked me off. You have one good remote viewing session and you know what it took me 50 years to find out.
Well, here's the interesting part. I remote viewed the JFK assassination, and in this session, I never saw the president. I never saw the guy in the limousine get hit. Mm-hmm. I never said it was president. My point of view was the spectators.
Yeah.
So now Daz, in his session, he got the limousine and he got the shots impacting. I never got any of that in my session. So
well,
I'm back
this
at the
is amazing.
Yeah, but you did I'm talk about these shooter teams, okay? And that's something I wanted to ask you. It seems obvious that you were seeing shots from two separate teams from the rear converging on the car, but there was some lines you drew. Did you get the impression there were shots from the front? Or rather from the south side of the plaza?
Okay. I thought if you look at that picture, the big picture of the people, the umbrella guy with the guy with his fist in the air.
Uh-huh.
My point of view was the lady in the pink in the foreground to her left. I was about there.
Okay.
And I felt there were shots coming from my left across the street.
That's
and then a couple shots. And then a couple shots from the buildings behind.
Okay, look at the picture with the limo in it, ladies and gentlemen. The color picture. And Dick is talking about the woman in the extreme foreground with a little pink dress on. She's got white or gray hair. She's walking toward the street. Now, I want to do one quick thing here. Let me back up to that wide, great big picture. And, Jim, I'm looking at the curb, and I see a yellow patch about 4 feet, and then I'm going to move my eye to the left. At the left side of that picture, I see another yellow patch painted on the curb about 4 feet, and nothing in between. You
now,
see that?
Where do you see?
Look at the picture. It's the big.
Limousine.
It's the no. This is not the limo picture. This is the people running across.
Oh yeah.
Now look at the curb.
Oh yeah. Right over there.
Yeah, you can see it up right behind E. Howard Hunt.
That's right. And then look up.
See the other one down
on
here.
On the left, at the left side.
And see, right in between is where the headshot took place because these people are running, and at the very bottom you can see the concrete sidewalk, and then you see more concrete, and there's a woman right here with a package in her hand. Those are the steps that lead to the grassy knoll.
Unbelievable. That's so.
Okay.
That is the yellow you were talking about. You can see it right on the curb.
Are. And they were fresh that day. And today you can still see vestiges of that paint on the at curb.
Well, it'd probably be gone by tomorrow morning now.
Now we're talking about it.
Now look at that. Look at that. That is the death zone right there.
Right there.
Unbelievable. Dick, thanks. Go ahead, please.
When I drew the park area, and in the picture you can see my pen is touching that area, I said there's something like a curb here. I pointed to that area, but I didn't know why.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
Okay, so then we go back, and I'm there in the, I'm looking at the buildings, and I said, what are the smells here? And I said, Vitalis. I smell Vitalis.
Now you have to tell people what Vitalis is.
It's hair
in the
green.
Session when you watch the video, and you can see, you can go to farsight.org, www.farsight.org, and there's a link, and it costs $12 to watch it. But in the session, I say, "Oh, I get a smell of Vitalis," and in while I'm remote viewing, I say, Vitalis is what I used to wear in my hair. We used that in the 50s or the 60s. Like
all the men,
like
all the men had grease in their hair. Everything was greased back. Look at the old movies; they all grease their hair back.
Yeah,
and this is important because Jeff, you didn't post the picture I sent you of the blow up, but you know there are still people who are trying to say that the driver of the car shot Kennedy.
Oh, it should be up there. Let me see.
I don't know what happened, but anyway, you can plainly see that it's sunlight glinting off of the hair of the two Secret Service agents in the front. That's driver Greer and Kellerman, and the reason that it's glinting so much is because all the men at that time put grease in their hair, and Vitalis was one of the popular brands. Right, Dick?
Yeah. Well, when I said Vitalis, and in session, it just popped out of my mouth. I didn't know why. I said, this is what people used in their hair back when I was 10 years old. I was born in 53, so I was 10 years old. I turned 10 in November of 63. So that was my subconscious telling me this target is 63 when you were 10 years old. And then I was talking about the crowd, and I said, they're not dressed up, but it's not like casual Friday. And so that was me saying it was a Friday. It's interesting how little voices from your subconscious get blurted out.
That's right.
Anyway,
and if you look at the picture of the crowd, you'll see that here's one guy in a tie, but here's another guy in not a tie. Here's a student. Here's a guy in a jacket. You know, it was just it was a cross section of the people in Dallas at that time. And by the way, the picture of the big picture with all the people rushing towards the camera up on the grassy knoll. If you look in the upper right hand corner, you'll see one of the turrets of the old red courthouse.
Sure, yeah, it's right
and
there.
It shows you where it was and how that they had a real vantage point there to see, watch what was going on in the whole plaza.
Well, you look at that picture and you look at those two pieces of yellow curb, and that was the death zone. That was the end of John Kennedy. Right between those two yellow painted curb sections. Man.
And, and I would simply, on the broadest possible view of this thing, if it was a lone nut, if it was Castro agents, it was Soviet agents, it was rogue CIA, if it was mafia hitmen, if it was any kind of low-level plot, they would have investigated, they would have found it right away. Dick says this in his presentation. I think Daz also says the same thing. This occurred. The power came from the absolute top. Okay, this came from the president, the level of the president, and the people above.
President. Yeah,
yeah, yep. Above the president.
Well, can you imagine what it would take to be in Dallas, Texas, and sight down your rifle on the president of the United States and pull the trigger? If you're not crazy, you're not a lone gunman. You're working for someone. But you have enough trust in that system, and you know that there's enough power that you can take that shot.
With impunity.
With impunity. And I talked a little bit about that in the second.
Like, well, hey, Dick, how about this? How about if you're a professional military marksman and or organized crime hitman, and you were told by people that you know are at the highest pinnacles of power in this country that it is sad but necessary for you to take out a threat to our national security? That would work.
It still takes some brass cojones to pull that trigger, man.
That's true. But if you're a pro, I believe it was you that said it yourself.
Yeah, I said
they're
these guys are professional. Yeah.
Okay, they were excited. They got a rush, but they weren't panicked and they weren't fearful. They just did their job, and they knew they had immunity, and that they could get away with it.
I said, I got a lot of the crowd. I got people, I said it was like the herd is spooked. They're running every which way. They don't know which way to go. Some are falling on the ground. I even said one guy is holding his child. And then I saw the woman, and I saw her really closely. I saw her face and her eyes, and she put her hand over her mouth. And her thoughts were my thoughts. It was like, oh, my God. And in the session, in the video, I actually choke up. Like, I go, can't breathe. And my breath caught. I was experiencing what she was experiencing. And I don't know if that was one of the, was that Jackie Kennedy? Was that one of the women? I think it was a woman in the crowd, probably.
I do, too. I couldn't tell you who that was because all we have are these still photos from that time. But I do know, and I know Gene Hill, who was standing there, said, you know, first off, everybody stood there for a moment in shock because it's like, what was that? excuse me, and then they began to figure out that there'd been a shooting. The motorcade took off. They started, sirens started, you know. A policeman jumped off and pulled his gun. There's a picture of him with a pistol in his hand running up the grassy knoll. But he got up there and he looked around.
I drew that in my session. I said,
yeah,
there's a cop.
Exactly. And there's photographs of the guy with his pistol out. He dropped his motorcycle. He ran up the grassy knoll with his gun in his hand. But he got up there, and then it's the same thing with Jean Hill. She, in this picture of everybody running, you can see, by the way, you just mentioned the man holding his son. Look right to the left center, and you'll see Charles Brim in his white jacket, and he's holding the hand of his little son. So there's the man holding his son. Jean Hill, who's in the red raincoat, you don't see her in this photograph because she led the charge up the grassy knoll. She's already out of the frame of this picture. Well, she got up there, and I said, well, you know, who do you think? She knew just instinctively the shots came from behind that fence. So she ran up there, and I said, well, what did you think you were going to see? I said, why would you run towards a place where you think there was a shooter? You know, and she said, well, I wasn't thinking. I just thought I needed to get up there and see where he went so I could point him out so they could catch him. She said, but I got up there and looked over the fence, and she said, all I saw was some policemen and railroad workers. And the railroad workers, by the way, Dick, is where I think you had a little bit of analytic overlay because you talk about the stockyards and you talk about the the different smell. I think what you're talking about is the railroad yards, which were right behind that picket fence on the grassy knoll. And you had the smell of railroad yards, you know, creosote and all that stuff,
yeah.
The railroad ties and just, you know,
yeah.
Oil and stuff like that. And also, the you mentioned people in coveralls, there were people dressed like railroad workers. And so, and they were professional enough not to be running away. So nobody knew. And by the way, was it you who mentioned that somebody took a rifle and broke it down, or was that Dez?
Yeah. I said, I was looking at, okay, who fired the shots?
Yeah.
I said there was a guy in a coat or a jacket.
Yeah.
And then there was a guy that had like work clothes on, like coveralls.
Yeah.
And with might have a name tag over it and a hat.
And didn't
and
you mention
said,
a bag, a tool bag?
Yeah, I said he had like tool kit, and they broke the rifle down, and they put it in with the tools.
Okay, here's a real quick remote viewing question. Just take a second, think deeply, get your first impression. This tool kit, was it hard or soft?
My impression from the session was that it was hard, but I have learned later that it might have been soft. So
okay.
I couldn't
well,
honestly,
that's really not fair because if you see a case and you know there's tools in it, you know, you don't usually think further. But yes, but everything you just said jibes with a witness called Ed Hoffman, who actually saw what happened behind the picket fence, and he saw a man in a coat and tie. That's the guy you mentioned, with a rifle. He ran down there. He tossed it over a steam pipe that was at the west end of the picket fence to a guy in a railroad worker's outfit, who then got behind a switch box, broke the rifle down, and put it into a toolbox or a tool bag, and slowly walked away.
A soft brown bag.
Yeah. But the way he described it, I thought it was one of those soft Brakeman's bags.
Yeah.
But, you know, he could have been mistaken, too.
Yeah, now I'm putting that little section up as well,
Jim. And then I thought, yeah, I clearly felt there was somebody with credentials that was saying, like, don't come here. Like, hey, we got it under control.
Yeah, that's the fake Secret Service guy.
Driver. Yeah. Well,
we're updating Jim's photos, by the way, with some text, a little excerpt from his book, Crossfire, that explains just what we're talking about. The rifle being tossed over to somebody down below, broken down, put in a bag. That'll go in there as well. Go ahead, Dick. We got time here.
I need to send you one more. I need to send you one more picture. Let me send it right now as my drawing of the shooters.
All right. Would you like that up as the The second to last picture, third from last? Where do you want it?
Yeah, towards the end.
Okay.
Webmaster. It's Rents.
Just send it, Rents Webmaster.
Okay, I got it.
At Gmail, all right.
And one more. How do you do this, Jeff, with a brain injury? You talk on the radio and keep a show going, and you do stuff on the...
I'm instructing James what to do with all these pictures, so it's okay.
Super hose. Okay, it's on the way. So, you know, Daz also did a session on this, and his stuff is interesting and focuses more on the Kennedy and the limousine. I never saw the limousine. I more saw the people and their reaction to it. I heard the gunshots, and I heard, like, pop, 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 pop. I would have said five. How many shots do you think there were, Jim?
Well, it's hard to say, but what I figure, because I can almost tell you each one, but that'd get into too much detail. Let me just say that I think there were three. I mean, I think this was a classic military-style ambush, and if you followed the classic military tactics, there would be three shooter teams, okay? There would be the shooter, there would be his... assistant, I guess, or whatever, spotter.
Uh-huh.
And then a third guy who would be there to protect their rear, okay, and keep people away. These are the guys with the Secret Service identification. Okay, so if there's three teams, and I think they fired not three shots, but three volleys. And since they were radio coordinated, see, the very first one, and some of them may have had silencers, but since there's bullets flying and they had to come up with a believable story, somebody fired a rifle that you could really hear the loud shot, okay? The others were muffled. But with three teams, I think they fired three rounds each. That would be nine shots. But you didn't hear pop, pop, pop. There was pop, pop, power, and here's why. On the first shot, they're radio coordinated. It's ready, aim, fire, blam. You got one big volley, and it sounds like one round, okay? But now they get the signal, you know, the umbrella. Hey, more shots are called for. Okay, now you're shooting at the president. You've already fired. He's not dead. You've got to get the next one going. So now you're rushed. So now they're not quite as coordinated as they were on the first shot. So you get a pow, 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 okay? And the others, depending on the distance and depending on where the individual witness was, then it's easy to tell them, well, there were three shots and the rest were echoes. And most people bought that. So I think there were three teams. I think there were nine shots, but they were fired in three volleys.
Makes
wow.
Perfect sense.
You're going to do a commercial, Jeff?
No, or? We're going right through.
Wow. Okay. You're working for free tonight. Okay. So the last picture that I uploaded was me looking at this, and I had said the word assassination, and you see the Gothic building on the right, and then I said that was the command and control high up in that. I said there was a scrambler. They were using a high-tech radio that had a scrambler, and I said this was state-of-the-art at this time. And then I said I had two buildings. And I said, the stockyard, I said, one shot came from the stockyard. You see a horizontal line and then two lines that make a V. I said, those were where the shots came from, those three areas. That was my sense of it. So
there
in relation
go.
To and, the Gothic building.
And I think what that translates into, from what I know, would be shots from behind the fence on the grassy knoll. That's the one parallel. And then there were some shots from the school book depository for evidentiary purposes. And then there were some other shots from the Daltech building, which is right behind.
And
right
I said, now this could be AOL, but when I got a sense of the people in the Gothic building, I think I said there was a gun team up there, but they didn't shoot. There were guys up there with rifles, but they didn't take a shot.
Backup. Hmm.
Something like that.
Well, so, and it could be because, Dick, let me tell you something. There is a, some of the researchers believe, and I tend to think it's probably true, because if you think about it, whoever was responsible for this assassination, they could not afford to let Kennedy get out of there alive. If he did, he would have sent every federal agency after him, okay? So they had to make sure. So there is the idea that along Stemmons, after you curve on Stemmons towards the trademark, there were people reported being seen with rifles, and there's even a photograph. It appears to be a man with a rifle on one of the business buildings there overlooking Stemmons. So the idea is that this was a backup hit team just in case he managed to get out of the plaza alive. But they didn't fire. Nobody fired.
Let me ask you this, Jim, because you and I were both police reporters.
Right.
I interviewed Ted Bundy once. I interviewed Ted Bundy before he was charged with murder.
Wow.
I was a young reporter in Utah, and he was doing his little serial killing there, and every weekend, it seemed, there was a woman turning up dead, a young, beautiful young woman. They arrested him for burglary. He was arrested for having burglary tools. And I remember being in the newsroom, and we had this mugshot of this guy, and we were saying, oh, my God, that's the guy that's been killing these women, but he's only been arrested for possession of burglary tools. How can we put this on the lead story? Like, why does it matter that this guy, Ted Bundy, Theodore Bundy, was arrested for burglary tools? We couldn't say because he wasn't charged with that.
That's right. You couldn't say
that on the news.
Yeah.
Okay, we couldn't say it. How is it that they tried, convicted, and identified Lee Harvey Oswald about 30 minutes after they picked him up? Tell us about that.
Okay. I think the most telling thing I can tell you to explain that is that about 1988, they released thousands of FBI documents, and one of them showed that about 2 hours after the shooting, that would have been 2:30 in Dallas, but that would have been 3:30 Eastern time, J. Edgar Hoover called Robert Kennedy, and he said, we have our man in Dallas. It's Lee Harvey Oswald. He's an ex-Marine. He defected to Russia. He's a, quote, mean-spirited individual in the category of a nut. Okay, so here, right there, 2 hours after the shooting, J. Edgar Hoover is telling everybody that it was a lone nut. Okay. Now, the thing that I got to point out is that Oswald was arrested an hour and a half after the shooting, and then had to take the drive to downtown Dallas to the police station. And when he got there, he had two sets of identification on him. One shows he's Lee Harvey Oswald. The other shows he's Alex James Heidel. And the cops are saying, hey, which one of these are you? And he's being uncooperative. He said, well, you're the cops. Figure it out. So in other words, at a very time of about 2:30, 2 hours after the assassination, when Oswald had just arrived at the police station, was uncooperative, and the local authorities weren't even sure who they had in custody, J. Edgar Hoover's already got the whole thing nailed down. It's a lone nut. He's a communist. I knew all about him. And this is really nothing too surprising, because there is a document three years earlier, 1960, from J. Edgar Hoover to the Security Division of the State Department, in which he warned, he said, that there is someone using, that may be using the birth certificate, an imposter using the birth certificate of Lee Harvey Oswald, and do you have any information on this individual? So now, wait a minute, isn't that incredible? The head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, personally knew about Lee Harvey Oswald, and in the context of someone impersonating him in some sort of intelligence operation 3 years before the Kennedy assassination.
Uh-huh.
So that's how they
wow.
knew
okay.
who it was.
Jeff, this video that we have out presently is the JFK assassination part one. And it's available now. If you go to farsight.org, you can look at it.
Okay.
There's another part coming out on November 22nd. Courtney Brown is editing that right now. After we did this session, We turned it in. We didn't get feedback. We were given two other targets, which were totally unrelated. It was something else in history that, you know what it is, Jeff, but we'll it was unrelated to Kennedy. It had nothing to do with Kennedy. It was something, a different continent, a different time, a different...
To be another blockbuster, but this, what we're hearing tonight is just staggering.
Okay, so we did the first Kennedy target, and then we did two other targets. And this was over the course of 2 months. And then we were tasked a fourth target. And the fourth target was, who planned the Kennedy assassination? And that's the one that's going to come out on November 22nd. Jim has seen a couple of the sketches from that, but we might have to do part two on that one.
Jeff, we definitely have to do that, because this is where my interest is today. I have long since, in fact, in my course at the university, beginning in 1975, mm-hmm. we went through the coup d'etat and the multiple gunmen and the shots from the grassy knoll. And, of course, that has never been told to the wider public because of the control over the mass media. But my interest today is who was truly behind it. I mean, anyone could have killed Kennedy, including the proverbial lone nut, but who authorized it? Who organized it? That's what I want to know, and this is what they have worked on, and so we need to have another show.
We will. We will do it.
Yeah, that'll be coming out later. So this one is something to chew on, and Jeff, you've got to have Daz on and Courtney Brown next week, because Daz has a whole other view of the... My session really was the... What happens when you remote view, we found? There's something called a division of effort. It's a psychic or a subconscious level. If you give three viewers the same target, only one gets the front row seat. Everyone else is going to get the peripheral data. And my data was the layout of the area, the survey of the area, and the people and their reactions to it, not the limousine, not the person being shot. That's what Daz saw, and you'll see that in his session. So anyway, Jim, thank you so much. It is so interesting to get that feedback for my work, because towards the end of the session, by my last sketch, I say, is this the effing Kennedy assassination?
That's right. That was great. What an epiphany for you.
Yeah. Well, like Mel Riley. Just like Mel Riley.
Yeah. It provoked an emotional response in you, didn't it?
What's that, Jim?
I said it provoked an emotional response in Dick, right?
Yeah.
Well, remote viewing, it has an impact on you. I spent weeks coming to grips with this target. I mean, I was in tears home alone when I got feedback and I looked at my work. I was home watching my own work crying. And I didn't understand a lot of it until tonight. I didn't know there was anybody there. Radio. I didn't know the police were keeping people out of certain areas.
Mm-hmm. Well, that answers so many questions. When you look at the pictures, we've added to Jim Marr's picture photo session. Take a look at those. You'll see everything up there now. And you can listen to the program on its second run through tonight. You can listen on the archives and track along that way, too. Now I understand why there are so few people on the grass behind the limo as we watch it from the Zapruder film. They were told to get out of there.
Right. Now they were prevented from getting there until the motorcade got there.
Yeah, now we see the yellow painted curb marks. My God. Right there.
Amazing. Jim Marrs, where were you on that date? What were you doing?
I wish you hadn't asked. Great reporter that I am. I was asleep. No, Dick, I was a sophomore in college, and I was already on a degree plan for journalism. I'd already worked at the Star-Telegram, and I worked at the Denton Record Chronicle, and I was a page editor for the campus newspaper at the University of North Texas. And I'd had a test that morning, an English test, as I recall, and so I'd been up all night cramming, you know. And so I came back to my apartment about 11 o'clock and fell in the bed and went to sleep, and my roommate ran in right after the shooting and said, "Wake up." They shot Kennedy. And I said, "What?" So we jumped up and we turned on this little cruddy black and white TV we had. And I remember I was sitting there watching the whole thing unfold. And for at least 15, 20 minutes when they finally came on and announced that he was dead. So that means I was watching the thing on TV probably no more than about 10 or 15 minutes after it actually happened.
Well, I was in fifth grade at Pierce Elementary School in Birmingham, Michigan. But what just occurred to me, we believe from our work that when you remote view an event or a location, that part of you actually goes to that actual event in its own place in time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was sitting in my fifth grade class in Pierce Elementary School when they told me the president's been shot, you can all go home, you know, go home to your families. But at that moment, part of me from the future was in Dealey Plaza. That's something that really bends your mind when you think about that.
Well, we need to learn more about remote viewing. I know the very first time I tried it, I accurately depicted the floor plan and the visual image of a office building which had not yet been built.
That's called future viewing.
Remote into the future.
Yeah.
Yep.
It happens.
It's all possible. It's all possible. Yep.
Well, we'll have Daz on and Courtney next week, and then when you're ready with that other part, we'll do another program on that. Dick, thank you very much for sharing.
It?
Wow.
Dick, you did an incredible job. You need to congratulate yourself.
This is amazing.
Thank you, Jim, and thanks for coming on. I that means a lot for me to be on a show with you. I really appreciate it.
Well, we'll do it again. Thanks, Dick.
Okay, bye-bye.
And James, wow, that's all I can say. Stunning.
Well, I was right.
Look at that yellow.
It takes 52 years, but maybe we'll finally get to the truth of it.
Yeah, well, they may have done it with their session. Those yellow marks on the curb are really, really haunting.
And keep in mind that there are at least four separate remote viewing of the Kennedy assassination, and they all agree on conspiracy multiple shooters.
I agree. Thank you, my friend. Talk to you soon.
Adios.
Okay. Jim Mars. All right, that's our program tonight. We're running a little bit late, so we will say good night, and we'll talk to you in 21 hours.